Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last week we spent a good bit of time talking about the EPI report that came out that pointed out that CEO pay since 1978 has jumped a whopping 940% over that time period. And yet the rest of us, us poor working schmucks, have seen just about a 12% raise over that same period. And I said last week, you know, this is not new. This isn't really news. This is what has been going on and what we've been saying on this program from the beginning. And this has everything to do with the fact that over those same years, you've seen a dwindling of union density. You've seen massive outsourcing. You've seen corporate America really put its thumb down on the neck of working people. And so I'm not surprised. The question is, how are you going to get out of that? How do you spin this around? This is that question, which is why I've asked Steve Greenhouse to come talk with us. He's a former New York Times reporter and the author of numerous books on labor, the state of labor. He's the guy I go to. He's the person that I look to when I want to know what's going on in labor. His latest book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Steve, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be here, Rick.
So the past, the present, and the future. So you believe American labor has a future?
Yes, I do believe it has a future. So you mentioned what happened with the CEOs and pay for regular workers. And one of the main points I make in this new book is that, you know, corporate power is, you know, the strongest it's been in decades. Worker power, worker leverage in politics and even in the workplace is the weakest it's been in decades. And that's really bad for, you know, workers. It's really bad for America. It's really bad for your listeners. I think the fact that corporations have so much power and workers, unfortunately, have so little power, and unions are, are weaker than they've been in decades, that, you know, I think that has contributed to decades of wage stagnation, to the worst income inequality since the Gilded Age of the 1920s. And as you suggest, it's really skewed our whole system, especially our political system, so that corporations and the Koch brothers dominate. And, you know, we can't, you know, even though minimum, you know, dominate, they got a $1.5 trillion tax cut, even though corporate profits are already at record levels. But we can't get a minimum wage increase passed, even though the minimum wage hasn't been increased in the longest time since...
Over a decade.
Since the minimum wage was first established. And there's something really broken, and I tried to explain why it's broken, and a lot of that is that unions have gotten so weak. And why have unions gotten so weak? A lot of that is that corporate America has declared war against unions, and so has the Republican Party.
Yeah. And look, at the end of it, it comes back to politics. And I say all the time, you know, you go back to the 1935 National Labor Relations Act. There's not a syllable, a sentence, a paragraph, a page in there that gives employers any rights in the original act, because they understood that employers had all the rights. What it did is, for really the first time in human history, in my view, it gave workers some bit of rights, some bit of ability to bargain for better wages, hours, and conditions, and the rule of law to back that up. Now, from that point forward, the Republican Party and centrist Democrats have done everything they can do to destroy that, which is why we are now.
Yeah, one of the reasons I read the book is that, unfortunately, far too many Americans, especially young Americans, don't understand much about unions and don't begin to understand all that unions have accomplished for Americans. You know, factories used to be incredibly unsafe. You know, workers used to work 55, 60, 65 hours a week. Thanks to unions, we have a 40-hour week. I love the bumper sticker, unions, the folks who brought you the weekend. That's really, really true. So in the book, I explain the rise of unions, some of the great, great historical events like the Flint sit-down strike and Walter Reuther and the Memphis sanitation worker strike, which was a huge win for civil rights and for workers' rights. And then I talk about the unfortunate decline of unions and how that has hurt workers. I look at the Patco strike, Scott Walker and his billionaire buddies, crusade against unions, and how all that has hurt not just unions but many workers. And then I look at models for rebuilding worker power like the 5-for-15, which has done a great job raising wages for millions and millions of workers, and the teacher strikes, which are really startling because I came at a time when many people thought that unions were like asleep or dead in the water. And all of a sudden, these teachers in West Virginia and Oklahoma and Arizona were just so fed up with the lousy pay and with being pushed around by Republicans who were, like, giving huge tax breaks to business and just, you know, squeezing down teacher salaries. You know, the teacher strikes really showed what Workers United can achieve and how the teacher strikes helped not just the teachers, but they helped students. They improved the schools. They improved school funding. They improved schools. They improved class size.
Right.
So there's some really promising things out there for labor, like the teacher strikes and the fight for 15.
Yeah, but don't they all go back to it? I've been saying, you know, and look, I've talked about all those events as well. In fact, you know, we were in Wisconsin sleeping on the marble floor while all that was going on, broadcasting from within the state capitol as that was going on. And I remember at the time, at the beginning when we were there, you know, it was basically a workers' movement. I mean, the international unions hadn't really gotten there yet, and it was basically a ground-up movement. Of people who were demanding that, hey, you know, this is our thing, and they encouraged the community and brought the community, and so it was kind of a whole ground up thing, much like the teacher strikes. You know, the teachers were out there, and they got parents, they got local businesses, because they understood that all of them were involved in this. This is, to me, the message that I think labor needs to figure out and how to go forward with is how to engage the community. Because I would argue, you know, while they did all those great things, ended child labor and brought us the weekend and safer working conditions, better wages, better hours, all of that stuff, they've really done a crappy job of telling their story.
You're right, Rick. I think they're learning. And you know, I write about this in my book in several ways. You know, the Los Angeles teacher strike, you know, one of the biggest teacher strikes and one of the biggest strikes, period, in decades, they weren't pushing so much for higher raises. They were pushing, and they worked for years, you know, getting the community behind them, getting parents behind them. They demanded, you know, smaller classes, more nurses per school, more librarians per school, more social workers per school. A lot of, you know, kids that go to public school in Los Angeles are from very poor families. They live in not nice areas. Teachers demanded more green space for the kids. And they really built a true community union alliance that I think helped excite more people about unions. I have a chapter about the teachers union in St. Paul, Minnesota, that really believes in bargaining for the common good. And they don't bargain just for higher wages. They bargain for smaller class sizes. They see that, you know, students of color are disproportionately punished, and they want to study that to figure out how to deal with that. They also push for more school psychologists, more social workers, more librarians, more English as a second language for the many immigrant children in the school. So the unions are getting the message that, you know, they can't appear just like self, you know, narrow self-interest, that to win fights and to inspire people about unions, they really need to work with the community.
Right. But isn't that the history of, I mean, you go back to the, you know, the 20s into the 30s. Wasn't that really the pitch then? I mean, this is not new. Again, I like to say
absolutely.
This isn't new, but this isn't new.
I mean, absolutely right. I have a chapter on the first event site. And the strikers at that huge GM plant, you know, in Flint, Michigan, which was a pivotal, you know, I think it was the biggest labor victory in the whole 20th century. You know, it was the workers were totally right, working hand in hand with the community. You know, wives, friends, kids, they came and showed their support. And they, you know, sometimes tried to block the police, and the police were trying to attack the strikers. And somewhere, you know, in the 50s or 60s or 70s, we can debate with, you know, unions started relying. They said, we're sitting pretty, we're doing well, we don't need help from the community. And I think they forgot the importance of, you know, working with the community. But now, as labor numbers have faded from 95% of the workforce to 10.5%,
right,
you know, they realize, hey, we got to do something to get out of this trough. And one way is to build community support.
Yeah. The book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor, written by Stephen Greenhouse. I'm sure you can get it at Powell's Books or the other, the A Word. I'm sure you can find it there if you need to. I'm sure it's going to be in a lot of places. Let me ask you this, because, you know, I look at, you know, virtually throughout history, every progressive step forward in this country, be it the civil rights movement, be it the women's rights movement, labor has been kind of in the middle of all of that. It's kind of been where a lot of the funding came from. And, you know, the assault on organized labor is not just an assault on workers, but it's really an assault on, you know, the critical parts of our democracy.
I totally agree. I think, you know, unions play a very important role ensuring that typical Americans have a vote, have a voice in politics and in the workplace. And, you know, unions played a key role in getting the civil rights legislation passed, getting Medicare passed, getting Medicaid passed. Just a few years ago, they played a decisive role when President Bush was trying to roll back Social Security protections and reduce Social Security benefits. And it was really labor that stood its body in the way and stopped that. And in that way, it really helped tens of millions of Americans that don't even begin to appreciate what labor did to help them. And one more thing. So in the book, I write about the Scott Walker's and the Republicans' war against labor in Wisconsin.
Right.
And they really eviscerated, weakened labor unions in Wisconsin, so much so that since over the past decade, unions in Wisconsin have lost 43% of their members, 166,000. So when you look at what happened in 2016 elections, Trump won Wisconsin by 22,000 votes, and the union membership is down 166,000 votes. And I strongly believe that if those 166,000 people were still in unions and unions were communicating with them about the advantages of Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump, if they're really communicating them with them to knock on doors and talk with their friends and really mobilize them to get out to vote, you know, I think Hillary could have won Wisconsin. And Michigan next door, union membership sadly has declined by over 150,000 over the past decade, largely because of the crisis in the auto industry during the Great Recession. Yeah. And Trump won Michigan by 11,000 votes. So when unions grow weaker, that helps the Republicans, and that leads to things like trying to, repeal Obamacare, trying to, make Medicaid much worse, trying to roll back Social Security benefits. So unions are really play an important role for creating a social safety net and strong social benefits for tens of millions of Americans.
Yeah. So what do you say to, the person? Because, every once in a while I'll put out a tweet saying, hey, attention union members who voted for Trump. This is what's happened. Is this what you voted for? The Janus decision being one. Most recently, the change in at the NLRB that's going to, in my view, going to be really destructive by allowing companies 90 days before the end of a contract to say, well, we don't think the union has majority of support. File for an election. All of these things that he's done, all of these regulatory changes, all of the deregulation, all of the attacks, do you think, union members are going to wake up from this?
I think some union members are waking up. Trump, I live in New York. I followed Trump for 30 years. I thought he was a demagogue and a con man, going back decades.
Me
even
too.
From when he was a Democrat. He ran as a champion of workers, and I think that's a big reason he won in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio. But then he's been a president for plutocrats and not for workers. He's done many, many anti-worker, anti-union things. He's rolled back the plan to extend overtime to millions more workers. The Obama administration began a very good rule to require Wall Street firms to act in the workers' and the retirees' best interest in handling the 401(k)s. He scrapped that rule. If you want to unionize Uber and Lyft drivers, they need to be defined as employees. Trump's National Labor Relations Board is saying, no, they're independent contractors. We shouldn't consider them employees. That makes it much harder, almost impossible for them to unionize. And Trump's NLRB has taken, many steps to make it harder to unionize. One last thing. And then he's appointed judges who are very anti-union, even anti-worker. His appointee, Judge Gorsuch, was the pivotal vote in a really important decision that said corporations have every right in the world to prohibit their employees from bringing class actions, and they have to go to arbitration.
Yep.
And all these arbitrations greatly favor corporations. And if you're an employee who suffers from wage theft or racial discrimination or sexual harassment, it's often far, far, far more effective to bring a class action. It's often very hard to get a lawyer unless you could bring a class action.
And this
Supreme Court decision basically said, tough luck, workers. We're making it much, much harder for you to be able to sue. And that decision really sets back worker rights in a great way and in a terrible way. And I think many workers don't begin to appreciate the importance of that decision.
Yeah, but in his defense, if you will, we were already moving in that direction because we've been screwing consumers with forced arbitration clauses for over a decade. So the court has been moving in that direction, and I've been saying we're going back to the days of Lochner. You go back to the Lochner era, which, you know, the government could do nothing, no maximum hour laws, no minimum wage laws, no nothing under the guise of liberty of contract. And now what we're hearing is freedom. Freedom, Stephen, instead of liberty, but it's the same crap, just repackaged.
You know the Janus decision. You know, people do compare to the Lochner decision, or the decision saying that setting, I think, maximum hours for workers. I forget if they've been in Oregon.
And, it was New York, the New York bake shop.
New York, 1905. The Supreme Court, the very conservative Supreme Court, said that violated, you know, this magical freedom of contract that's implicit in the Constitution, that, you know, a lot of people say was just made up of whole cloth. There's nothing in the Constitution about freedom of contract. And my feeling about what's happening with Trump is, I think he's been anti-worker, anti-union almost across the board, except in one area, trade. And I think that's the one area where he's kind of remained true to his pledges to get tough. Right. And I think while he does 95% of other things against workers, the one that's getting a ton of headlines is what he's doing on trade. But, you know, I believe, you know, for instance, he says he's going to fix NAFTA. He's made NAFTA a lot better for corporations, but he hasn't made NAFTA much better for workers. And the thing the unions wanted most about NAFTA is really strong, enforceable worker protections. And when the Trump administration renegotiated NAFTA, it didn't, you know, the new version doesn't call for strong, enforceable worker protections. No. That's why unions continue to oppose the new version.
Right.
And on China, I totally agree that China cheated on trade, and I'm sorry that, you know, George W. Bush and Obama didn't get tougher towards China. And it's good that Trump is standing up to China, but he's going about it totally the wrong way, and that's hurting American farmers, it's hurting American consumers, it's hurting American workers. You know, the smart thing for Trump to do would have been, well, we want to confront China, which is cheating on trade. So we need to line up our allies behind us, the European Union, Japan, Australia, Canada. But Trump has alienated so many of our allies that they don't want to work with us, and he likes to go it alone. So he's banging heads one-on-one against China, and China is a very powerful country. So it's hurting American farmers very badly.
Yeah, you were right there, almost right there. China's a very important and very powerful company. You're right. They are a company country.
Country.
they really are. So let me ask you last line of questioning, because today we see the story coming out of the Washington Post that the business roundtable, all the CEOs, I guess there's almost like 200 of them, they've now decided that maximizing shareholder wealth is no longer going to be their prime focus, and now they care about customers and employees and suppliers and local communities. This is the new business roundtable. And my first thought was, well, you know, there's nothing benevolent here. They know the pitchforks are coming out at some point. This is about self-preservation. I'm curious your thoughts.
So I keep referring to it. So in 1991, I write in my book, in 1991, the Business Roundtable, you know, the heads of the 200 largest companies, adopted a very nice sounding, you know, motto program saying, you know, we have to serve all our stakeholders, including workers and the community. Then, whoops, 6 years later, they totally revamped their program, their plan, saying, no, we have to focus on shareholders, Uber Ellis. Maximize profits. And boy, I think, you know, we've seen, you know, results of that. You know, profits have zoomed. We've seen huge numbers of factory closing, much less loyalty to workers. Many more jobs have moved offshore. And you're right, Rick. I think the public is very, very angry at corporations. And corporations see they have an image problem, not just in how they treat their workers, but on, you know, cheating on pharmaceuticals, cheating on test results. So they announced this, and now the question is, will they do anything about it? And I, you know, 15 minutes ago before we got on the phone, Rick, I just tweeted out that if they were really sincere about this, they would ask Congress to repeal the over $1 trillion in tax cuts for corporations and say, we don't really need this. We're worried too much about profit maximization. Why not you, the federal government, use this money to deal with far more serious problems like the homeless crisis or the affordable housing crisis?
Yeah, that's a lot more. That's a heavier lift. Good luck on that. Absolutely. And I wouldn't hold my breath.
Like, if they're really serious, you know, like get off their derrieres and do something. They don't need this one. You know, they had record profits. The stock market was at record levels.
Yeah.
They needed, you know, another $1 trillion. You know, $1 trillion tax cut. Like you and I need another. You know what? So, but it was unfortunate. They're all about profit maximization, and they promised a lot of this money was going to worker raises, and that didn't happen. But, you know, $800 billion of that money went to, you know, share buybacks, which, of course, helped the wealthy folks who own stock.
Yeah.
So that's just another indication of how skewed the whole system is in favor of corporations and the rich, and how workers often get the short end.
But at least we've got the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. Again, the book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, The Present, and The Future of American Labor. You can check that out. Look for Powell's Books or the dreaded A Word or your local bookstore, written by Stephen Greenhouse. Stephen, I appreciate the time. Great work. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks. Great to be here, Rick. Good luck.
Good stuff. Thanks so much. Again, like I said, Beaten Down, Worked Up. Make sure you check that out. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. And listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.